Business Source is proudly sponsored by JCH Communications. When it comes to marketing, we mean business. From websites to videos, we can guarantee you a return on your investment. Take a look now on our website at our video, www.jchcom.com.
Welcome to Business Source, brought to you by Connecting Business, the show that gives you authentic conversations to help your business. As usual, there's no smoke and mirrors, just real people sharing their experiences. And I'm your host, Lee Nightingale, and today I'm delighted to be joined by an amazing person, Tim Ash. Tim is an awesome key speaker, advisor, trainer, as well as being an author of a hugely fascinating book called Unleash Your Primal Brain, which I'm really looking forward to getting into. So let's get into it. Tim, hi, welcome for joining us.
Hey, Lee, it's my pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Tim, you have such a fascinating background and career history and education path, and I'd love for you to roll it back for us and just give us a brief look into time, if you will, over your career, including what looks like a phenomenal education at San Diego University.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll start at the beginning. I was born in Moscow in the USSR, and we were one of the first wave of, I guess you'd say, Soviet Jewish emigres that were allowed to leave the country. This is early 70s. And we ended up in the US, and my parents were both civil engineers, which was kind of like the software engineering of its day, a very portable profession. So they had a good second career in the U.S., working with large construction companies. And I moved around a bit when they worked and was on the East Coast of the U.S. And then I got a full ride UC Regents academic scholarship at the University of California, San Diego, UCSD. Nice. And it's a school with an amazing backstory of its own. It was started in the 1960s. As a graduate school for the hard sciences. So they recruited a bunch of Nobel laureates in physics, chemistry, biology, Fields Medal winners in math. And then after doing that for a few years, they started letting in undergraduates. So even though the school's been around some 60 years or so, it's actually ranked as top 30 in the world as a university. Just this phenomenal reputation. For me, it was a good engineering school. It was about 5,000 kilometers away from my parents on the East Coast of the U.S., and it had a nude beach next door, so it was kind of a no-brainer.
Well, I was just about to say, I mean, San Diego is a place that we've both got huge familiarity with. I traveled there over the course of 8 years with WebSense, the technology company I was working for, and it's really not a bad place at all to spend your time. The beautiful sunshine, you know, you get that mist that rolls in the morning, 10 a.m., that burns off, and it's just another sunny day in Southern California. Great beaches, just such a wonderful part of the world to be.
Well, and we're recording this in January. Today it's unusually warm, but still it's going to be 27 degrees today and sunny. So just to make you feel jealous, back in jolly old England.
Yeah, and we're at about 2 or 3, dropping down to like -1 or 2. What did you study there?
I double majored actually in computer engineering and cognitive science. So I always describe it as the software and the wetware. UCSD was very interdisciplinary, so the cognitive science department had a lot of different influences. It was in the psychology department at the time, but later became its own top department. And I stayed on at UCSD for a graduate school. So I got my master's, advanced to candidacy for my PhD, and spent 7 years in the PhD program in computer science there. My work was focused on what was called neural networks, or machine learning these days, artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And basically, it's combining teaching computers to learn from example with a kind of brain-like structure, if you will. And back in the day, we were working on the algorithm side, how to teach the computers to learn. What was missing were the big data sets Obviously, with the advent of the internet, that's no longer a problem. So now the field of AI has really taken off because you have both the algorithms and the data to train them on.
But that, and we obviously deal with big data with handling CRM and Salesforce and everything, but browsing habits, you know, that can only give you so much in terms of, well, this person's made this decision to do that action on this website, probably because of these reasons. Do you think that really gets you inside their brain in terms of what makes them and their overall thought process?
Well, I think the algorithms can capture a lot of nuanced information. They are a black box, and I have some ethical issues with that because they can build in human biases from the data they consume or things that are socially unacceptable, like discriminating against a certain class of people. But they are able to tease out really, really nuanced stuff. For example, if you ask people, this was just some study that I read about just this week, to look at someone's face and then say, is that a Democrat or a Republican in the US, okay? The people do slightly better than a coin flip. They do 55% accuracy, so not much better than a coin flip. Well, it turns out that neural networks trained on faces from dating sites where people talk about their political affiliation can basically predict your party 75% of the time. Way better than humans can. So imagine, I can look at your face and I can to say you're a Democrat or you're a Republican with much higher accuracy than human beings. That's scary.
Gee, wow, now we're really going down a rabbit hole because, you know, I've watched The Great Hack and a couple of other programs that talk about the way these social media companies are using AI and particularly the likes of Facebook, etc. Cambridge Analytica, and this is why I don't really post very many photos at all on social media, and especially none of the hey, here's me age 7 and 10 years later, here's me now. I mean, you're just giving them free of charge AI data, and all these photos of faces and how they progress, and I'm not a fan of contributing towards that, although obviously I understand the more you do contribute, the better the AI can possibly be.
Yeah, well, there's definitely some ethical questions about it. I know a couple of friends of mine, Kate O'Neill and Stefan Hamill, are working in that area. And I think as business people and as marketers, we're all responsible for keeping that top of mind whenever we use these kind of systems. I'm not okay with them running open loop without human supervision because you get things like we have in our political system, and that's not just in the US, but extreme polarization due to algorithms and such, and the destroying the very notion of truth or factual information. You know, that's a deadly thing for democracies to be playing with.
Yeah, I think in my mind, what I'm okay with is, to a degree, giving me targeted ads based on the things that I've been searching for, so long as those things aren't guns, violence, weapons, you know, or that kind of thing, revolutions, I wouldn't necessarily say, but terrorism and that kind of stuff. I'm not okay with that. So, you know, I guess this is where they're battling over who makes that decision on what people can and can't see. You know, it's either freedom of speech and it's everything, or you're restricting it. But I think as a global species, you know, we have a right to protect the masses of the species against people that want to look at and research, you know, things that they shouldn't really be doing. And I think the social media platforms have a responsibility for cutting that out.
Yeah, I think there's a movement starting right now in academic and technology circles to make data privacy key. So the idea is you have a lockbox with all of your data, and if somebody wants it, you can say, okay, I'm going to open up this subset of it and give it to you. But basically, you're always in control of your data instead of other people data mining you and strip mining you. I think that's a step in the right direction for sure.
Yeah, definitely. So the cognitive science, computer engineering, PhD, What next? Once you'd completed all that, what was you thinking? What, how did you try and harness all that information and think, right, this is what I'm going to do next?
Well, I actually didn't complete it. So 7 years into the PhD program, I was 29 years old, and I said, I'm not going to start my fourth decade on this earth still in school. So I quit and I started my first company. And I didn't need a PhD to do what I do. Computer science PhDs are really only good if you're going to be teaching at a world-class university. And that was never my path or intention. So I'd worked at the larger companies that didn't feel like home psychologically either. So I had that entrepreneurial itch and took down 200 square meters of office space, got an internet connection, and started my first business, an internet agency to help launch new dot-coms. This was back in 1995. And so I've been riding that entrepreneurial roller coaster for 25 years now. From the very early days of the internet, and I've seen a lot. So I started applying everything I knew to marketing, essentially to internet marketing. And we drove traffic to websites, we helped build websites, we helped launch new startups that get them venture capital funding and so on. And what we focused in on after a while was not driving traffic to websites, which is what most people were doing, but making the websites themselves more effective. So I guess you could say my agency, Site Tuners, was a pioneer in the discipline of what's called conversion rate optimization or landing page optimization. And along the way, I wrote a couple of best-selling books on it. This is the second edition here, Landing Page Optimization. And it's been translated into six languages and sold 50,000 copies, which for a business book is pretty solid, I understand. So
Nice.
it's kind of the, I'd say, the Bible in the field. And we created over $1.2 billion in value for clients like Google and Nestle and Expedia, on down to much smaller, nimble companies.
Wow. I mean, and you were there for like 19 years or so. So, I mean, we're talking, I guess, it would, like I say, one thing is driving traffic, getting that traffic to actually engage with your content and knowing, looking where they're going. I mean, even so much as cameras, actually watching people's eyes and where they're going, where their mouse is, does it hover over a certain area? Are they reading a certain part of the page? Hotspots, I think they call it, sort of optimization and making sure that they do multiple clicks throughout the site, right? And ultimately engage in the content.
That's right. So conversion rate optimization is basically persuading a higher percentage of your visitors to act. And acting can mean call us or fill out a form or download something or buy something. The call to action can be different, but the persuasion principles are pretty much universal. And it's a combination of art and science. There's, of course, everything in internet marketing is infinitely measurable, and that's great. But really, we're talking about psychology and persuading people. So the tools that we deploy are often qualitative, like you say, user surveys, watching how they interact with websites, that sort of thing, focus groups. So it's not always quantitative. In fact, one of the problems with the field as it stands right now is that everybody's using split testing tools. Like, I'll show you version A of my content, and I'll show another half of the people version B, and which one does better. And the over-reliance on split testing is kind of used as a crutch to me to settle bar bets, is how I call it, and not to do anything meaningful. So sometimes you have to train your customer service people. Sometimes you have to change your back-end email sequences. Sometimes you have to redesign your whole site from scratch and start over. So there are a lot of tools besides just a little tactical fiddling and what color should the button be.
Yeah, right. Because it, I mean, simply 50-50 or every alternate one gets A, B, A, B, A, B is not a science, right? That's for sure. And you could just be completely unlucky or lucky in your the people you get within your A or B.
Well, I would say that testing itself isn't the problem. Testing, all it does is validate, did you have a good idea and did it make things better or worse than what it's replacing? So I have no problem with it at that level. But if that's the only activity you use to optimize your business, that's very restrictive. That's fighting with both hands tied behind your back.
Yeah, and I'm really interested because obviously, and I don't want to labor on this because there's so much more to get hold of, but digital marketing and website optimization, landing page optimization, in your professional opinion, does it all change dependent on the type of industry of the business that's got the website? So, for example, your website has is different from my website, and people's behavior on your website versus my website could differ because of a difference in what we offer.
So the answer, and you'll hear this from me often, is yes and no, or it depends. On one level, you can, for example, contrast consumer purchases with business-to-business purchases. At the consumer level, if I buy something on Amazon and I don't like it, I'll return it for free. In a business-to-business setting, if I'm making a decision about some invasive technology that I'm going to run my whole business on, the stakes are much higher. So there's a level of organizational risk. Our whole company can implode if we pick the wrong system, for example. And then there's personal risk. I could get fired if I make the wrong decision about this system. So business to business decisions are more complicated and there are more stakeholders, but ultimately we're trying to convince people and persuasion of people. I think there are some universals in neuromarketing and other areas that you can apply. All of us have a brain. That's ultimately what you're trying to persuade.
So dumbing that down for my simple brain, if you will, if you're B2C, invariably it's just, hey, here's some great products, photos of the product, just here's a description, here's some reviews, here's a buy now button, boom, there you go. Versus a B2B where I have to, in as fewer words as possible, explain why they should fill out that contact form to speak to me or pick up the phone and speak to me because I can't display the product. Of course, you can get customer testimonials, but not quite the same.
Right. So the emphasis is different. Again, there's a simpler, as you mentioned, call to action. And most consumer purchases are small amounts of money. So are you willing to do it or willing to sign up for the trial, that sort of thing. With business to business, there are many stakeholders. There's the financial person that has to pay for it, the legal compliance people have to sign off on it. There's the end users of the system. There's the people that'll maintain it and operationally. And each of them have their own set of concerns. So you really need this kind of role-based website where there's each of them are getting their needs met and you're speaking directly to them. So that's part of it. The other thing is that it's a much higher risk for me to try an expensive product. It's very hard to unwind that. So if I switch accounting systems at my company, I can't just go back to my old one tomorrow if I don't like it. So there's this unknown and risk factor, like and that you have to get people over the hump with things like testimonials, but testimonials from people in my exact situation. So for business to business, it's important to have targeted testimonials in each of the industries you're trying to persuade.
And now, did that lead to your involvement with the Digital Growth Unleashed conference side of things, where you were, I don't know, is it coaching training about the complete customer journey? Do you want to just share a little bit more about that that events conference side of things?
Yeah, so about 10 years ago now, I started a conference series that was focused on conversion rate optimization, on making websites more effective. And it was the first industry-wide conference that brought together practitioners, agencies, people inside of companies, as well as all the vendors. So it was a big tent approach to it. And we ran it. Used to have three shows a year in the US, but now it's one show a year in the US, one in the UK, and one in Germany every year. So it's still going on. And about 3 years ago, we rebranded it to be Digital Growth Unleashed instead of Conversion Conference. Because Conversion Conference, like I said, had become too narrow and people were just talking about that green button, orange button testing, I call it, just very tactical stuff. And to us, it was about growing your whole business. So everybody in the business is involved in optimization. And so it was a refocusing of it, but to broaden it out, but rather not refocusing, but broadening of the focus, but still the emphasis is on making web experiences more effective. And I was involved with it for 10 years. I chaired it, but I stepped out of that a couple of years ago, along with selling my stake in my agency, Site Tuners, to focus on keynote speaking, my new book, as well as solo advisory consulting, which I enjoy very much.
That book, Unleash Your Primal Brain. We're going to get into that in just a minute. That's got to have been, well, I guess you did the math and calculated the percentage risk on walking away from those that career and going it alone as an entrepreneur, even though you already were an entrepreneur. But it takes a certain skill, a certain confidence, a certain strength, knowledge, experience to stand upon a stage and share what you know with other people in a way that they can resonate and connect with and learn and everything. We've all been to so many conferences where you just stand there and most people are actually on their phone because they're not engaging with the speaker. They're just talking drivel.
Not in my keynotes.
No, I don't imagine so, because from that experience though, from SiteTuners and Digital Growth Unleashed, what were your key takeaways from that? What did you think? Right, okay, starting out for myself now again, I need to make sure I do ABC.
That's a great question. What really motivated me was it's a blessing and a curse, but I do pretty well at whatever I put my mind to, and I'm pretty stubborn and not afraid of hard work. So over the years, everything I've tried has panned out to some degree. But I really realized that running a professional services firm, which a digital agency is not my highest and best use on the planet. I mean, I don't care if you're a tax attorney or a LASIK eye surgeon or a digital agency head like I was, but essentially you have problems of clients turning over all the time and keeping your employees happy. It's about as complicated a business model as you can get, short of running live conferences. that one also has moving parts and time pressure and a bunch of external factors you can't control. So I had been playing with the two most complicated business models out there, professional services and live events. And then I kind of fell into both of them. And so I had to really step back in midlife and say, what am I good at? What's my highest and best use? What can I make money at? What do I enjoy? All of those things combined. There's a Japanese concept of the overlap of those is called your ikigai. My purpose on earth, if you will, how should I express it best? And it came back to what am I good at, which is that evangelism, insight, training, education, solo consulting, where I can work one-on-one and really get things done with decision makers and executives. Mm-hmm. So it was a very deliberate step away from running a professional services firm. And even though for about 3 months there, I felt kind of like a turtle without a shell. If I'm not the CEO of my agency, what am I again? About a 25-year career in this. I knew I'd be successful. I'd keynoted at over 200 events around the world and on stages as big as 12,000 people. So I knew it's not like I was starting from scratch by any means.
Right, yeah. Yeah, gotcha. And so you presumably brought all of that knowledge, experience, thoughts, insights together and used your education to write Unleash Your Primal Brain, right?
Yes.
Do you want to just explain the concept of that before we dig into some of the amazing details in it?
Well, sure. I guess maybe the best place to start is to talk about why I wrote it. I guess you could say I came full circle. So I started in cognitive science and persuasion, how the brain works and learning. And then I took that into marketing and I ran my agency and we created all this value for clients. But I realized that we're just moving money around. In some sense, if you're running a marketing agency, you're making one company more effective at doing something and taking the money from their competitors and putting it in their wallet, right? So yeah. It's not like we're curing cancer or doing something, meaning of life stuff here. So I wanted to just broaden all of these insights that I got from my marketing work and bring it to the general public. And back in the US, we had this amazing book and TV series by an astronomer named Carl Sagan. It was called Cosmos. And the Carl Sagan was like, made it easy for the public to understand. It was like billions and billions of stars, you know, that kind of thing. And I wanted to do something like that for the human brain because I saw all of these different takes on it from neuroscientists and marketers and economists and habit change people and personal growth people. Everybody was talking around the elephant, but nobody was seeing the elephant. And I wanted to say, look, the red thread through all of this is evolutionary psychology. The brain didn't just pop into existence. If you want to understand it, you have to retrace the whole evolutionary arc to understand what makes us behave the way we do. And I wanted to bring that to all people, not just business, but for relationships and personal development in a very readable way without any of the studies or footnotes or graphs and arrows and tables. So it's a very readable distillation of but that's at the same time pretty ambitious. I don't it's, I'm not dumbing things down.
I've read the book, and there was parts in there, a part in there where I was like, is he telling me that I actually don't need a brain? You know, because there's part of the animal kingdom that, you know, we didn't have a brain, then we got a brain, but we could probably do away with it now. I don't know. What's your thoughts there? How did you get to that summary?
We need a brain certainly if we're going to survive. Brains really evolve for the challenges of moving through the environment. If you're a plant, and you just plant yourself and you grow, you can sort of adjust to the local environment by facing the sun or sucking up water through deeper roots or healing wounds by having sap cover them. And so there are intelligent responses that help you survive, but that's not the same as a brain. The brain is needed because things that are changing quickly in the environment through which you move through, you need to adapt to and respond to. And so that's the basis of it. So insects have a brain, but plants don't. And anything more complicated than an insect definitely needs a brain.
Okay, so this is where I want to get into the book some more. The difference between our primal brain and conscious brain, because it sounds like there's stuff that's pre-programmed that we through the history of time, and then there's stuff that actually I can control.
Yeah, I start the book. My first chapter is The Lie of Rationality. In Western thinking, back to the days of Plato and Socrates, we have this notion that there's this wrestling match between the wild animals of our emotional brain and our logical brain, and that really the highest achievement of human beings is to be logical and rational and have conscious thought. It turns out that's not true. So what I'm trying to do is rebalance the scales and say, look, 95% of what got your ancestors here was that primal brain, the one that's fast and makes quick decisions and works tirelessly and automatically on your behalf. And that's the one that actually initiates actions and makes decisions. The conscious brain can't decide. It can provide you with options, and that's it. It can't pick among them. The choices are made either through instinct or through emotions, which are based on your past experiences. So we
So you're
go
talking
toward,
about,
sorry.
like, should I jump off this bridge? I mean, the primal brain.
That's rarely a good idea, but
Well, yeah,
yes,
but
that's.
is it the primal brain that stops me because, oh, if I do that, I'm going to
I'm
die?
going to die. So there's this strong negative thing. This is going to lessen your chances of survival. So we move towards things that give us pleasure and away from things that cause us pain or loss. So basically, those aversions and affinities are in play in any given situation, and the strongest emotional response is going to be the direction we go in. And without emotions, we literally can't make a decision. So there is no such thing as logically thinking through something.
Although, of course, controversially, as men, we're often thought as having little to no emotions. But we're very emotional people. We just don't talk about it and share it, right?
Yeah, that's a cultural overlay. I have a couple of chapters on culture, which is its own really fascinating subject and one of the things that makes us unique among animals. But we're designed for culture spread. So even that notion that you just said, men shouldn't show their emotions, real men don't cry, that kind of stuff, that's a cultural learned artifact that you have in your head in England. It may not be the same with some Mediterranean countries, for example. Expressing your emotions is perfectly fine for the Greeks or Italians.
Oh, yeah, definitely for the Italians. So do you Do you think we're able to, I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this, reprogram our brains because of these neurological pathways to change our habits? So, for example, like if I've smoked for 20 years, do I have the power in me to reprogram my brain to say, I don't smoke anymore and I'm going to stop smoking and over time? And I don't just mean an instantaneous thing, right?
Well, let me break that up into two parts. One is talking about brain development, the other one about addiction, as I think both are relevant. So from a brain development standpoint, we have the most plastic brains of all animals. A lot of animals come out pre-wired. A giraffe can drop out of its mother and within a half hour to an hour stand up and on the first day walk and follow mom. Okay, that's pretty good pre-wiring. Human beings are useless blobs. As you know, you have a young kid, they fart and sleep and cry, and that's about it. So our development takes a long time, and we're busy pre-wiring our brain, or not pre-wiring, wiring rather, and learning by watching people around us since we can't actually interact with the world too much. So human brain development doesn't actually end till our mid-40s and isn't substantially complete till our mid-20s. I have a couple of teenagers in the house, and let me tell you, their brains are not wired yet for impulse control and a lot of other emotional control things. We have the tabula rasa or blank slate, and we learn from our surrounding experiences, but that takes a long time. So there's that aspect of it. Once you get older, it's actually harder to change habits. There is a study that a lot of our habitual things, like if you haven't tried sushi by the age of 30, there's a 90% chance that you never will, kind of stuff. So we get kind of set in our ways as we get older, and it is harder to change things when we get older, I'd say. The other, sorry.
Interesting because that very same analogy. I learned to eat sushi over the age of 30, and prior to the age of 30, I could not stand a glass of red wine, and yet I do now in my mid-40s. Because I trained myself. I thought, well, I understand I'm supposed to drink red wine with red meat. It's supposed to enhance the flavor. I want to get the best flavor possible. So I'm just going to push myself through and keep trying red wine. And now I couldn't be, if I was being honest, I wouldn't sit here and say, that's amazing. What a wonderful bottle of red. I just go, that tastes nice. That tastes all right. And or that tastes not so nice. And I know what I like and I don't like. I don't know why. And I can't describe all the flavors and smells and all of that. But I have programmed my brain, if you like, and myself to like fish and
Right.
red
So
wine.
then now we're getting into the realm of either willpower to override certain things, which we can do, but that comes from our conscious brain and our reserves of executive function, the ability to override things, to kind of keep an overwatch on them, declines over the course of the day. For example, there's a famous study of Israeli judges who are much less likely to allow parole for people if they're hungry. So you want to get them at the beginning of the day or after lunch. Otherwise, your chances of getting paroled go way down because they don't have the glucose in their brain to make good decisions anymore. So willpower only takes you so far, and it runs out pretty quickly. So now we're getting into habits and addictions, and I would say that here the news isn't as good. It's very hard to override our kind of neurochemical helpers, substances in our brain like dopamine or oxytocin or endorphins. They are pretty much rule the show. And especially if you start introducing them from outside, our brains produce all of those substances for survival reasons. But if you get dopamine from cocaine, or you get oxytocin from Molly in quantities that are 100 times stronger than what your brain produces, you've permanently dampened your brain's response to normal life. And then addiction is a horrible consequence of that.
Interesting, because that was in fact partly my next question about our brains learn from repeated events, they become habits. So my sport is golf, and they say, muscle memory, to keep repeating to do something, to do something, to do something, and also not just the swing muscle memory, but your whole pre-shot routine and your whole practicing ethos, the amount of time you get to the golf course prior to teeing off, your warm-up process, repeat, 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 repeat.
Yes.
Because then it just becomes habit, and it's all fine. And you can, once you become comfortable with all of that, then you can kind of start to take on board other things. So if I take, say, me as an amateur golfer, I go to my golf course, I play, there's just those people that I'm playing with on the golf course. Maybe there's people on other holes around, but there's very little noise. But if I hear a leaf blower going off or a car drive by, I'm very aware of that. Whereas you take a professional golfer and they've now been able to block out tens of thousands of people in the crowd and beer vendors, food vendors going on, cheers and roars and everything. They because they've programmed their brain to the process of everything they do, that's, they were able to sort of widen that normality, and but it takes a bit of time to adjust.
Yeah,
for that too.
Yeah, I would say that it's really a lot of things are through habit and through experience, and each one of those experiences is a learning event, and we pull out information. There is a general theory about how we learn. The four stages are unconscious incompetence. I don't even know what I don't know. Conscious incompetence. I know I suck. Okay. Conscious competence means I know how to do it, but I have to think about it. And then finally, unconscious competence, which is mastery. Like you say, at some point, it's just in me and I don't have to think about it. That's why a chess master can look at a board configuration and instantly tell, you know, everything they need to know from that, because it's inside of them and they don't have to think about playing out the different variations in their head anymore. So that's certainly true. The best way to learn, this is true of physical skills and kind of book knowledge, if you want to call it that, is actually to get a good night's sleep immediately afterwards. So staying up all night, burning the midnight oil, as they say, to do better on your exam the next day, or even, like I said, a physical skill. If you've been practicing your golf swing and you don't get a full 7 to 9 hours that night, you won't learn the physical skill. So basically, sleep pushes out unneeded stuff. It locks in the stuff you need and integrates it into long-term memories and fuses it with your prior life experience. And it creates room for new learning the next day. If you bottleneck that process by shortchanging your sleep, you don't get any of those benefits.
Well, that and probably 99% of those that golf tend to have a beer or two after the round, so thus destroying their short-term memory, right?
The 19th hole, right?
Yeah. And speaking of memory, then, so obviously there's these quiz masters that are on these shows and do professional quiz events, because you believe, you know, and I agree, use it or lose it, you know, you learn something. And I think all the stuff that I learned at school, probably 90% of which I've forgotten. There's certain stuff that I remember because I have chosen consciously to keep using it, but the rest is forgotten. So these quiz masters, you know, they are absorbing this information, and because they're regurgitating it and using it on a frequent basis, going from quiz to quiz to quiz to quiz, you know, I know that answer, I know that answer, I know that answer. Is that why they've got such good memories, or is there some trick, some art? And this is a really good one. About how to retain that information.
See, I'm going to start with your premise that that's a positive or desirable thing in the first place. Memorizing things accurately is not important. The purpose of memory, and many, I talk about this in the book, is not to be accurate. There is no black mirror, like the, I don't know if you're familiar with the episode where there's like a life rewind and you can go back to any point in your life and replay it. There's no such thing. You couldn't possibly remember all of the information impinging on you every second of every day. So you throw most of it out. So the one thing to understand is that our brain is an ignoring machine. It ignores 99.9% of the non-actionable stuff. And even what it chooses to remember, again, may not be committed to memory if we don't sleep. And then over the longer term, if it's no longer useful, it fades away very quickly. So the purpose of memory is to help us survive. It's not to be accurate. So I'm not in awe of somebody that just spends their whole life trying to memorize things accurately. That's not the point. It's to increase our survival chances. And usually memories are formed in the presence of strong emotions. So multisensory experiences with strong emotions attached. First time you rode a roller coaster, you'll remember that, right? Wind whipping through your hair, people screaming around you, G-forces conspiring with your inner ear to evacuate your lunch. I mean, that was a lot of really, really strong sensory inputs and emotions. And you'll remember that. But tying your shoes, do you remember the first time you ever tied your shoes? Probably not. You've done it 1,000 times and it has no strong emotions associated with it. So memory is very selective, focused on strong survival events, and is not accurate at all.
How might you describe a photographic memory then? Those people that can read a book, read a document, a contract, and then remember.
Well, I think that this is an important thing to understand. You know, we've been talking about our primal brain, the one that doesn't have access to language or rational thought and is making all these decisions in real time. And then our conscious mind, which has access to language and planning and memory and rehearsed tasks and things like that. And the thing to understand that's really, really important is that the purpose of the conscious brain isn't for computational tasks. The purpose of the conscious brain is to model our social environment. So literally, when we stop doing 2 + 2 = 4, we go back to simulating our social tribe, which had about 100 to 200 people in it. So if I do a good job on this podcast and I ask you to introduce me to another podcast host, you'll do that for me. But if I had, dated the podcast host's niece and she thought I was a jerk, then she's not going to recommend me. Okay, so those kind of social alliances and who's in, who's out, what are the power structures? That's what our brain is there to model. So the planning part or memorization part or thinking ahead part only comes into it for that reason. And there are some people that I believe my personal theory on it is that they're more on the autistic spectrum who don't pay attention to the social information. So they're the ones that are creating the art and the science and the engineering and all of those kind of technical advances. But because they have extra capacity, the rest of us are super spreaders of those ideas culturally and disseminate them throughout society.
So in layman's terms, you're saying that people that do have something like a photographic memory, it isn't something they've trained their brain to do. It's just that their brain is slightly different to mine, who does focus on this.
Right. So you know, that stereotype of the nerd or the mad scientist or the Einstein guy, you know, with his crazy hair because he couldn't be bothered to comb it. I think there's a truth to that. In other words, I think some of those people are on the autistic spectrum to some extent, and they have such strong social inputs that they actually scramble the signal to allow themselves to cope with it. That's basically the mechanism. They take a face and turn it into a Picasso cubist abstract, so they can't read minute micro expressions anymore. They go nose, eye, mouth, but they're not a unified object in their mind. And because of that, they have the extra capacity to do some of these memory and computational and I guess you'd call them engineering tasks or science tasks. Again, that's my personal view of it, not backed up by science.
Fantastic. And finally, Tim, do you believe it's possible to teach an old dog new tricks?
Well, we've talked about that. I think it's harder to do it later in life, for sure, as your brain gets locked in. It's important to support it with repetition and habit, as you said, certainly in the case of physical skills, but also mental habits. And I'd say it's important to do it with proper sleep, and to try to make the experiences as vivid as possible emotionally in order to get them stick better in your memory as much as you can control that environment. Make it fun or scary or a combination of fun and scary, but something that tells your primal brain to wake up because this is necessary for your survival.
So bringing that into real world environments, thinking about salespeople, it seems far easier to teach the 20 somethings, 30 somethings, new ways, new habits, do this, than to go, okay, I'll just do that. I'll do whatever you tell me to do. And yet you have some guys or girls or people in the session that are maybe slightly older, 50, 50 to 60, in their sort of twilight part of their career,
Hey, now
who
I fit into that category.
I'm glad I'm fast approaching it, Tim. Getting nervous about that, but the fact that they are evidently, clearly more difficult to coach because they appear to just not want to change. But what you're saying is because the way the brain works is because it started to switch off the ability to be able to change.
Right. Well, again, it's plastic, so it can take in the cultural and specific information about your immediate environment and your tribe around you and your physical environment. That helps us learn. So we're not pre-wired. But once that stuff's locked in and you're taking advantage of that local and cultural knowledge, the learning slows down quite a bit. But I think as we get older, the compensating thing is that we can extract these larger, deeper patterns of things. And so I think the focus shouldn't be on new skill learning. I'm not going to learn how to play my kids' video games. It's just not a good investment of my time. But learning general frameworks that are applicable in a broader range of circumstances, and that helps you to compensate for the lack of specific skills or knowledge. So I guess you'd say it's the trade-off between skills and wisdom. And you do definitely extract some of that more general stuff as you go through in life.
Fantastic. Well, let's end it there, Tim, because I could talk to you for days and days and days. And I'm so glad that we were introduced through our mutual contact, Tim Hughes. Thanks, Tim. Really
Great
enjoyed
guy.
getting yeah, really enjoyed getting to know you, and I'm fascinated by the book. Definitely going to be keeping an eye. Yeah, there we go.
There's the book, by the way. And if you're interested in the book, it's available in ebook and audiobook, which I narrated, as well as the print editions coming out in April. Go to primalbrain.com for that. You can get all the information, including the table of contents.
So the book's called Unleash Your Primal Brain by Tim Ash.
Yep.
You can also check out more about Tim at timash.com. Tim, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. I've thoroughly enjoyed getting into your brain and to how you see the world. Thanks so much, my friend.
It's been my pleasure, Lee.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of Business Source. Look forward to seeing everyone next time.